Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is James McMurdy.
There's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and now there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore. And that big old building was a textile mill. It fed our kids and it paid our bills, but they turned us out and they closed the doors. We can't make it here anymore. You see those pallets piled up on the loading dock? They're just gonna sit there till they rot, 'cause there's nothing to ship, nothing to pack, just busted concrete and rusted tracks. Empty storefronts around the square, there's a needle in the gutter and glass everywhere. You don't come down here unless you're looking to score. We can't make it here anymore. The bar's still open, but man, it's slow. The tip jar's light and the register's low. The bartender don't have much to say. The regular crowd's getting thinner each day. Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof. Won't pay for a drink if you gotta have proof. Try it yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far $5.15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore. And there's a high school girl with a bourgeois dream, just like the pictures in the magazine she found on the floor of the laundromat. A woman with kids can forget all that. If she comes up pregnant, what'll she do? Forget the career, forget about school. Can she live on faith, live on hope, high on Jesus and hooked on dope? When it's way too late to just say no, you can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin or the shape of their eyes? Yeah, right. Now I'm stocking shirts in the Walmart store, just like the ones we made before. Except this one came from Singapore. I guess we can't make it here anymore. Should I hate a people for the shade of their skin or the shape of their eyes or the shape I'm in? Should I hate them for having our jobs today? No, I hate the men sent the jobs away. I can see them all now. They haunt my dreams, all lily white and squeaky clean. They've never known want, they'll never know need. Their shit don't stink and their kids won't bleed. Their kids won't bleed in their damn little war. And we can't make it here anymore. We'll work for food, we'll die for oil, we'll kill for power, and to us the spoils. The billionaires get to pay less tax, the working poor get to fall through the cracks. So let them eat jelly beans, let them eat cake, let them eat shit, whatever it takes. They can join the Air Force or join the Corps if they can't make it here anymore. So that's how it is, that's what we got, if the president wants to admit it or not. You can read it in the paper, read it on the wall, hear it on the wind if you're listening at all. Get out of that limo and look us in the eye. Call us on a cell phone, tell us all why. In Dayton, Ohio, Portland, Maine, or a cotton gin out on the great high plains, it's done closed down, along with the school and the hospital and the swimming pool Dust devils dance in the noonday heat, and there's rats in the alley and trash in the street. Gang graffiti on a boxcar door. You can't make it here anymore.
Ready for some tranquilizers? I know I am. Should we switch to American Idol now that reality is just too painful to watch? Ah, no. This is a great opportunity for community building and activism. That is what this program, Radio EcoShock, is all about. Capitalism may be faltering, but lots of people are also organizing for a better system. You'll find events all over your city. Look for them. Go, participate, talk to people at work while you still have work. Let's cooperate here. I'm Alex Smith with the Radio EcoShock Show. There are some real solutions out there. It's a new solution to save our atmosphere without spending trillions of taxpayer dollars. It's all about putting carbon back into the soil and into the sea. How can we stop runaway climate change and maybe save ourselves from extinction? That is the question of the day. Today we'll talk answers. No, not 10,000 new nuclear plants or mirrors to deflect the sun. A real way to work with nature to fix the problem. 2 weeks ago, a Radio EcoShock listener sent me a draft paper by Jim Laurie and his futurist friend Seth J. Itzkan. We have Jim Laurie with us to explain an idea that could rock your mind. Jim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. How you doing?
Doing pretty well, and I'm glad to talk with you. Before we begin, though, I want to ask, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I got my master's degree in biology at Rice University years ago. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I was a bird watcher as a kid. So I studied biology. Then I went to work in the chemical industry for a number of years, and I got a master's degree during that time. In something called Future Studies. And at that time in Houston, we were going to the moon, and it was real exciting. So I wanted to learn how big systems worked. And that's what I've been doing the last 20 years or so, is trying to understand if we were going to restore a planet or restore an ecosystem, how would we go about it?
Well, the division that you and Seth have developed has two major projects. It's both land and on sea, but I'd like to start with the soil building. How mm-hmm. could agricultural methods possibly reduce the amount of greenhouse gases in the air?
Well, when I read Peter Ward's book, I got, kind of in a state of shock, like a lot of folks probably did. And I did a calculation that next morning, and I thought, well, how much carbon are we talking about? And it was, it turned out it was 150 billion tons. 150 gigatons is the number. And there are, after some research, you realize there's about 15 billion acres of land that's been greatly degraded in the last 100 years or so. And that's what it comes to is it's like 10 tons per acre that if we could put back in the ground. And I think probably the number we could put back into the ground to make the soils healthy again would be 10 times that. So that would be a sink. That would be a way to do it.
Yeah, but we can't just shovel it in there. How are we going to get this, I guess you're talking mostly carbon, back in the ground, eh?
Yeah. Well, the deal is photosynthesis. Nature knows how to do that. Technology is like one leg of a table that holds up civilization. The other three legs are biodiversity. And probably the most important thing we have to learn is how to manage grasslands. So the perennial grasses grow really well, and in a lot of places in the world, the perennial grasses have been starving for nutrients because they evolved with grazing animals, but the grazing animals and grasslands co-evolved, and they would grow up shoots, and their growth points were near the surface of the ground, and they'd attract grazing animals. The grazing animals would convert all of that carbon that they'd taken in from the air into dung and urine, and they'd also, it was their own growth, and then they'd leave that behind. Now, the step we didn't know when we started putting cattle inside barbed wire fences years ago was that when buffalo were out there, that they moved as herds. And that was because there were predators around. There were wolves. There were big cats. There were Indians. And so they would move as herds. And when you do that, if you're a buffalo and you bring all your family with you, you've got, you're starting to stink up the place after a couple days, and you want to move on. And so they would never rebite the same grass within several weeks or maybe months. And then the story goes down in the soil. There used to be thousands of dung beetles on every acre. They'd follow the herds from the, you know, they could sense the herds from the methane gases that came out or whatever. And they would take, in Oklahoma, they had a rancher that quit using insecticides on his land. And within a couple of years, he noticed that the cow patties were disappearing, and he didn't understand it. And then he realized he had dung beetles on his land, and they were taking them down. And when the Richardsons, a couple from University of Texas, came up and started studying it, they found that these beetles could move a ton of manure per acre in 24 hours down, you know, several feet down into the ground. That in their life cycle, that's where the baby dung beetles get started. And within a couple of years after that, there was so much moisture in his soils that he had worms coming back. And then he had ants in his ground that he hadn't seen in years. And, you know, he had soils that were much healthier than they were earlier on. So
can we integrate that natural system, which was there before probably even humans got to the continent, can we integrate that with our present cattle raising?
Absolutely, and that's the interesting part of the story is this idea started in Africa by a wildlife range manager who was watching lands that he was managing turn to desert. And his name was Alan Savory, S-A-V-O-R-Y. And because of he grew up in Zimbabwe, and because of the civil wars over there and so forth, he eventually had to leave the country. And he came to New Mexico, and he was watching the same process happening in New Mexico and West Texas, that the land was gradually turning to desert in areas where there used to be, you know, really, really strong perennial grasses. And he realized that, you know, for instance, in Pennsylvania, where I grew up, if you left the land, you know, if you devastated a piece of land and you left it go, it would grow eventually into a forest, you know, because you have moisture all year round. But in most of the world, if you devastate a piece of land and you just leave it rest, it never comes back. It just turns to desert over time. It gets drier and drier. And he was convinced that the balance between plants and animals and soil microbes and so forth was the key. And so he started trying to move animals and learn about their timing. And after a couple decades, he figured it out. And I've been to ranches out in West Texas where they've got much more grass than they used to have. One ranch in particular, the family was $3 million in debt in the mid-'80s. They were desperate. And they thought they'd taken all the cattle off the land that they could afford to take off. And when they met Savory, they realized that to do a grazing plan that would work, they'd need four times as many cattle. And 8 years later, they had five times the vegetation on their land. And they had dung beetles, and they had a process. And they were also out of debt, which was huge to them. They were talking about taking vacations and doing things they hadn't done in years. And it's real interesting to see, you know, cattle ranchers becoming ecologists and students of dung beetles and so forth. It was quite exciting to meet them.
You even mentioned the role of that underground fungi play in this cycle.
Yeah, I've got a kind of an interesting background. I spent time in Minnesota studying wolves to learn about predators, and then I got a call from California to try to figure out how to restore an area that had turned to desert that used to be redwood forest. You know, the land got so dry, and there was so much erosion. And I realized that fungus, the mycelium networks in the soil were huge in that process. And so I started studying fungi, and I went down to Maryland and worked on a farm for a year to try to learn how to grow mushrooms and things. But that story just keeps getting bigger and bigger. A week ago, I was talking to Paul Hepperly, who works at Rodale. He's the research director down there. And I was asking him, if we can put a ton of carbon in the ground, how much water can it hold? It can hold like 8 pounds or 10 pounds or something like that. And he says, oh, no, you're way off. It's much more than that, that it might be 40. In other words, now you say, well, how do you put it down there? And he's talking about something called glomalin, G-L-O-M-A-L-I-N. It's a new word. It's glycoproteins that were found by this scientist named Sarah Wright at USDA about a decade ago, and she termed them glomalin to, you know. But the glycoproteins, well, that's sugar proteins that are put out by the mycelium network of fungi. They get enormous amounts of sugar from healthy perennial grasses. The grasses give over half their sugars to the mycelial network to go out and move nutrients in the soil. And essentially, it's like an intelligent process in the soil. But because it's like brain tissue, it needs to be kept moist and kept dark. And the way they do this is by putting out these, they ooze out these glycoproteins, and they hold enormous amounts of water. And when we started adding nitrogen to the soil from fertilizers and stuff like that, what that did is it increased bacterial populations, and they started consuming all these carbon networks in the soil, you know. It's interesting because they're finding out at research done at USDA that glomalin or glomalin, however you pronounce it, that there can be four times as much of that as there is of humus in the soil. Humus is more like bug poop.
So we could actually we could grow carbon under the ground and be grabbing it out of the atmosphere.
Absolutely, that's the whole thing. That process used to happen automatically when we had big herds moving. Under predators, and when we took the predators away, we thought we were overgrazing, and then you know we took more and more animals off the land, and the land never came back. And these were what Savory calls brittle environments. If there was one idea that people could think about in terms of thinking about the system, it's understanding what he means when he talks about brittle environments. But the exciting part is that. All that cast of characters are ready to go back to work.
This sounds to me like, you know, instead of it being the energy department that may save our climate, it could be the USDA, it could be agriculture. So what has to get organized to make this work, and what are our goals as far as reduction of greenhouse gases go?
Well, you think about it right now, in agriculture, the people that live on the land are, in a lot of places, barely making it. And we subsidize systems that destroy soils, you know, like they use a lot of fertilizers and chemicals and whatever. And sometimes that's written into their contracts. And what if we were to subsidize ecosystem services? Like if land holds a lot of water, there wouldn't, you know, it would be fewer droughts and fewer floods too, quite ironically. And if land had more carbon in it, it would be, you know, helping with the climate situation. And so there's a guy that I met recently named Abe Collins up in Vermont, who's a dairy farmer, and he's been working on, you know, how do I grass feed my animals and deepen my soils. And he's got a group called Carbon Farmers of America. And essentially what they're hoping for is that someday he'll be paid by the amount of carbon he's got in his soil. If it increases, he'd get a you know, a subsidy. And if it decreases, I don't know, maybe somebody'd have to pay into the system. I don't know. But he figures that the ecosystem services of a ton of carbon in the soil is probably worth $100 or more. And that might be a cheap way to move towards, security. You know, you say, how do you define security? Well, you know, I think that having a healthy landscape and having a future is a huge part of that. So,
definitely. Well, we're talking with James Laurie about an important paper he's developing with futurist Seth Itzkan. And let's move from the land to the sea. You know, Jim, as you mentioned, we've recently interviewed Peter Ward, author under Green Sky, and he finds evidence that the great extinctions were driven by changes in the sea, where bacteria belch out toxic hydrogen sulfide. That may be our greatest danger, and you've written about how we might avoid that.
When I read that book last November, I could feel that, you know, I have a lot of experience with hydrogen sulfide in natural systems, and it really makes you sick. And I had nightmares that night thinking about it. And but then I remembered something that, you know, people have been asking me, why are there dead zones off the coast of Oregon? Or why are there dead zones off Namibia where there's no industry at all? And what I think is happening is that, you know, there's in Namibia, for instance, there's big upwellings of nutrients at certain times of the year from the Antarctic currents. And there used to be like billions of sardines that would eat the algae. And if the algae doesn't get eaten, it'll eventually over, you know, it'll form mats and so forth. It'll start sinking to the bottom, and it won't be able to trap sunlight anymore. And it starts decaying at the bottom of the ocean and creating these huge dead zones. And that's similar to what Peter Ward describes. If we melt the ice and the ocean can't breathe anymore, eventually it'll start dying from the bottom up. You know, so then you start thinking, well, the symptoms of global warming might be ice melting and dead zones in the ocean. But one, you know, one way to reverse that is make sure that our algae-eating fish are healthy. And that went back to something I'm really incredibly interested in, is how do we restore the cod fishery off New England and Nova Scotia? And it comes back to a little fish called the menhaden, what we called in Maine the pogey. And, you know, and now think if you're an algae-eating fish, you know, where would you want to live? You know, and it'd be like, well, you'd follow the plankton. You'd go, you'd follow wherever that stuff was growing. Well, it doesn't grow all year round in New England. So they tend to migrate south in the wintertime, and they come back up north in the summertime. But we fish them out to such an extent that they don't make it to New England as much as they used to. You know, they don't have to go that far. There's not as many of them.
This is the menhaden you're talking about.
What's that?
That's the menhaden fish you're talking about?
Yeah, the menhaden fish. It's like when there were schools of these fish that were the size of counties, you know, like hundreds of square miles possibly, they essentially fed bluefish, striped bass, swordfish, cod, mackerel, mammals, whales, and seals, and on and on and on. It was like menhaden are like the experts at turning algae and phytoplankton into oil. And they're bony and they're not good to eat. But it used to be there were so many in New England that when the bluefish would capture a group of them and try to, try to consume them, they'd run everywhere they could, and a lot of them would end up on the coast of New England and in the rivers and whatever. And, the colonists would pick them off the ground and squeeze the oil out of them and then use the rest of the fish to spread on the land. It was like a nutrient that it was added to the soil. It's the Squanto story of the Pilgrim days. And that fish, I think, is the basis of the whole ocean food chain here. And, the more we study this, the more we're going to see that the carbon cycle is mostly about algae taking it out of the air and going into, you know, moving up these food webs. And the algae-eating fish, the menhaden and the sardines and the anchovies are really important. You know, out where you are on the West Coast, they've got those dead zones in Oregon. Well, there used to be huge sardine fisheries off the coast of California, which don't exist anymore. And I think restoring those would be just, I mean, eventually that would be a huge economic plus, you know. And I'm kind of thinking if we want the cod to come back in New England, we're going to have to face the food chain issue and figure out how to restore menhaden and, you know.
Right, we cut out one of these important links. They seem like a small fish that nobody knows about, but then the algae can become toxic, create the dead zones, and the bigger fish don't grow, so we don't actually get the food fish that we wanted. So I can see there's a lot of work to be done there. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Jim Laurie about a new proposal to use both land and sea to reduce greenhouse gases and maybe save the climate of the world. Jim, where do you go from here? If people want to find out more, where can they connect with your new ideas?
Well, Steph and I are putting together a Google group called Soil Age, and it's got a dash in the middle of it, SOIL-AGE. And that's just starting, and we're not sure where it's going to go, but we're going to put the paper on there, and we're going to put references to where you can learn more about ecosystems and how they work. And I would suggest that people look up Holistic Management, which is the group that was started by Alan Savory in New Mexico. And there's one paper that's on there that's called News You Can Use, and they essentially have a dozen case studies of ranchers and farmers that have used this holistic management process to improve their land and their soil and their communities too. So, and another is about menhaden. There's a book that was recently written by Bruce Franklin, who's at Rutgers University, and he's a fisherman, and he went through the whole history of menhaden, and he wrote a book called The Most Important Fish in the Sea. And I think if light was brought to that, that would be a huge step. And those are some of the places.
Good enough. Okay, well, it's been really fascinating talking with you, and I think I'm going to try and develop some more about your paper with our listeners as we progress. Our guest has been James Jim Laurie, spelled L-A-U-R-I-E. He's produced a new program with Seth J. Itzkan, spelled I-T-Z-K-A-N, for rehabilitation of both land and sea called Soil Restoration, Ocean Anoxia, and Menhaden Reduction. I think this plan could work. You're going to be hearing a lot more about it. Thanks for being with us, Jim.
Okay, thank you.
All right, I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. Time to wrap it up for this week on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Tune in next week for a major speech on the sad state of the oceans. Canada has the world's longest coastline, but mismanagement has crashed commercial stocks that used to feed the world. Now warnings of continuing extinctions are being ignored by the government. Professor Jeff Hutchings' Lament for a Nation's Oceans is next on Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much for listening. We'll go out with a new discovery. Social poet and singer Eliza Gilkyson, spelled G-I-L-K-Y-S-O-N, from Austin, Texas. I expected a new breed of artists from our developing social woes, and Gilkyson does it for me. This is a clip from Runaway Train.
Everyone knew she was gonna be fast. Everyone said they could build her to last. 10,000 tons of hurtling steel, screaming around the curve, nobody at the wheel. Everyone said don't pay it any mind, there's a pot of gold waiting at the end of the line. Just move with the eye of the hurricane, we'll never get off of this runaway train. Snapped shut and the engines roared. They pushed to the front, they